Hierdie is 'n ma en 'n mikrofoon, 'n Afrikaanse podcast vir en oor Afrikaanse ma's en ouers. Ek is Daniella van Heerden, die ma agter die mikrofoon wat al die vrae vra. Welkom by hierdie episode. Ter in Junie vier ons natuurlik Vadersdag en daarom gaan ek hierdie maand se episodes fokus op inspirasie paas. Dis nie net Terrence Junie wat ek met mans gesels nie, hierdie is immers 'n podsending oor ouerskap, nie net ma wees nie, en ek dink mans en pa speel so 'n belangrike rol in 'n kind se lewe. Maar ek is regtig opgewonde oor vandag se episode. En ek wil sommer net eers sê, so rukkie gelede het ek 'n peiling gedoen op Instagram en vir die luisteraars en kykers gevra, sal julle omgee as ek af en toe 'n Engelse gas het, as daar iemand is wat ek dink regtig waarde kan toevoeg, maar hierdie persoon kan dalk nie goed Afrikaans praat nie, en oorweldigend was die reaksie. Ek dink iets in die 90% van mense wat deelgeneem het, het gesê ja, gerus, kry 'n Engelse gas. En hierdie is dan nou die eerste keer wat ek so gas het, en ek dink werklik dis 'n goeie keuse. Ek weet hier is baie van julle wat vandag luister wat hierdie storie gaan moet hoor. Dalk 'n ma wat luister, of jy weet van 'n man in jou lewe, dalk jou eie man, 'n broer, 'n pa, iemand wat jy weet 'n pa is, wat vandag hierdie boodskap nodig het. Dis die storie van 'n man wat deur ongelooflike trauma is, wat opgestaan het, wat beheer geneem het van sy eie lewe, en dit alles in die agtergrond van pa wees. Hy het 4 kleindogtertjies gehad toe sy lewe ontwrig is. Dis Joey Evans. Ek het hom gehoor as 'n motiveringsspreker by 'n funksie waar hy gepraat het. Ek het aan sy lippe gehang. Ek is geïnspireer. Ek het geweet hierdie storie is een wat julle ook moet hoor. Ek wil nie te veel verklap nie. Hy kan sy eie verhaal vertel en julle kan sommer ook na die tyd gaan Google en nog meer oor hom oplees, want eintlik is een podcast gesprek nie genoeg daarvoor nie. Maar ek is opgewonde om met julle die verhaal te deel van 'n wonderlike pa, 'n inspirerende man en 'n viering van vaderskap tydens hierdie Junie maand. Kom, ons gaan ontmoet vir Joey Evans. Joey Evans, welcome to A Ma in a Microphone. That's a mom and a mic in English. I know you're from the West Rand, Kempton Park, but you're not an Afrikaans East Rander, but that's okay. My listeners and viewers have said they're okay with English as long as it's a good guest, and I believe you to be. So welcome to my English guest, Joey. Just tell us in a nutshell about you and your family, please.
Cool. I appreciate it. And it's great to be here. Thank you for the invite. I'm Joey Evans. I'm a 51-year-old guy now, and I got married pretty young. You know, I was 23 when I got married, and I had 4 daughters pretty much right away. By the time I was 28, I already had 4 daughters. So now I'm a 51 guy who's still married with 4 adult daughters.
Wow, 4 daughters, well done, and like in such a short time, indeed. So there's actually so much we can cover, and I'm so excited to tell your story. But let's go back to the day of what a lot of the listeners and the viewers won't know now, but we'll call it the accident. And you can tell us about that day. I can see clearly they'll be able to gather that you are a motorcycle guy. We can see that from the helmets in the background. But there was a big accident that had a massive impact in your life. Tell us about that day, Joe.
Yeah, absolutely. So it goes back a number of years now. I was 32 years old at the time, so it's nearly 20 years ago now. And it was at a race. I was racing off-road dirt bikes down in Heidelberg, just south of Joburg. And I had a big crash at the start of a race where I was unconscious for several minutes. And when I woke up, I'd smashed out, most of my teeth, and I couldn't feel my legs. And so it was a day that certainly changed my life in a huge way.
How old were your daughters at that time? They were born already, right? You had 4 young daughters at that stage.
Yeah, there were 4 very young daughters. So they were, all 4 of them were born within 5 years, you know, so it was, and no twins in that. So yeah, it was some crazy times. But the day of the accident was the day before my eldest daughter's 8th birthday. So 13th of October, 2007 was the day of their accident. So oldest on that day would have been 7. And then going down from there. Yeah.
That must have been added stress to that whole situation of the impact of the accident, knowing that you are a father of these 4 young daughters and your wife as well. Can you take me through what happened after that? Because the impact and the result of that accident was actually life-changing.
100%. It was hugely life-changing. And when you say life-changing, it was obviously life-changing for me, which is quite obvious, but it was life-changing for my wife, Meredith, and for my daughters as well. At the time, I was self-employed, so I had my own little business, and a lot of it was work that involved manual labor and those kind of things. So I was effectively unemployed, basically, you know, unable to earn, you could say. So I've got my own little business, which has been going great and earning money. And now I can't do the work. I can't earn money. I was the sole breadwinner in our family at the time, in terms of, you know, my wife was a stay-at-home mom. And, you know, with four daughters, it's often, with four little children, it's often the more, how could I say, savvy financial decision, because with, school runs and all the sort of stuff that goes along with that. So it was financially devastating. It was physically devastating. It was a very, very dark time where the future just seemed impossible, to be honest.
Because what was your prognosis at that stage? The doctors said you were paralyzed. What did they say your future looked like?
Yeah. So what I did is I broke my T8 and T9 vertebrae. So it's about sort of chest height here. And I'd broken the vertebrae like off the ribs as well. And I crushed my spinal cord. And the prognosis was that I'd never walk again. I had no feeling from my chest down. And the days ticked away and turned into weeks with no feeling and no movement. And I was in this hospital and I watched my legs get skinnier and skinnier as the muscles atrophied. And it was really a time where we realized that, like, you know, I'm in a lot of trouble here. My family's in a lot of trouble. And to be honest, you know, as a dad and a husband, and, you know, you got that thing where you're supposed to be like, or at the time I felt very much like I was the breadwinner, I was the protector, I was filling all those kind of traditional dad and husband type roles. And I've messed up because, you know, sometimes people will have spinal cord injuries where they might be shot or they might be in a car accident or something like that. But I'm literally racing motorbikes. I was taking the risks, you know, the crash on the day, it wasn't my fault. Someone crashed into me, but I was racing motorcycles. You know what I mean? It's a risk, you know, the moment you throw your leg over that bike. So there was certainly a big feeling inside of me that I'd messed up and it's going to affect, my wife and my daughters and everybody has to pick up the pieces for my mistake is how it felt.
How did you get through that and move through that kind of like a mental block to get to a point where you were making different decisions to put yourself on a different path? Because your path did change according to what happened and what they said would be, correct? How did that happen?
100%. So when you're in a really dark place like that, and it is tough to even like feel like, is life worth living? Because when you get paralyzed, there's so many other physical challenges as well. You know, you lose all bowel control and bladder control and, you know, all these kind of things. And obviously I'm in a wheelchair and so it was like, you know, there's definitely that feeling of like, what's the point? And I think anybody who has a major injury, whether it's a spinal cord injury or a traumatic brain injury or, you know, these kind of things that really just change everything, there comes a point where you have to make a decision. And I think that was what happened with me. You know, I'm generally a really positive guy. I'm generally a guy who sees the possibilities and not the challenges and, you know, that kind of stuff. But when you're in a place like with something like this, it is so huge and so all encompassing. And in that kind of dark time, I looked at my life and I looked what I had and I thought, you know what, there's a couple ways I can look at this. I can either look at everything that I had and go, look how much I've lost. Or I can look where I am and go like, look where I am. And look how much I have. I could have died that day, but I haven't. I'm still here. I still have so much. You know, I still have my arms. I still have all my upper body. I still have, you know, my brain. I still have so many things that are of value. I still have my family. You know, my wife is determined to stand by me through this, whatever it takes, which made a massive impact, obviously, as well, having someone who can support you like that. And I have these four beautiful little girls that have their whole lives ahead of them. And I can still add a lot of value to this team that I'm part of. And I need to just look at like what I have and not what I don't have. And I think that kind of shift, seeing it that way, made a big difference. And suddenly every day became this challenge to keep getting better, to keep getting more. And I think that was probably the biggest psychological thing, was to accept where I was and then do everything and to better my situation, instead of saying that's who I was and look how much I've lost. And that shift in mindset was probably the biggest thing that helped me to go like, where to from here? And to stop feeling sorry for myself, for lack of a better way of saying it, you know?
But I have to put perspective for our listeners and viewers, those gains that you made after that, that was really small. You said it started with like a little toe movement, and it would be weeks of just the smallest little thing, moving. And like looking back, there were big changes. But in that moment, every day, the smallest thing would be a victory, right?
100%. And your whole scale of things change. You know, like my understanding at the time was that if you broke a bone, you can't race for 6 weeks and then you'll be fine and you carry on with your life. And suddenly I've got an injury that literally affects my whole life. Like it's a very big permanent thing. And one day, you know, something happened and I got this little twitch in my big toe, and then the days turned into weeks and into months, and I got a little bit of movement in my left ankle, and I was obviously in hospital for months and in the rehab and all that stuff. And slowly but surely, I was fortunate enough to get a little bit more and a little bit more. And we would do ridiculous things like time, how long it took me to get dressed. We'd be in the basement of the hospital with wheelchairs and basketballs and learning how to pick up a basketball in a wheelchair and seeing how quick you can do laps in a wheelchair. But it was all like little ways of measuring your improvement, measuring you know, every little thing you get, how many steps you can take. Because I started to learn to stand again with these braces on my legs. And then I started to learn to then stand without braces, but I couldn't walk, but I could stand, and I got these skinny little legs. And then we'd see how many steps, and then we'd do steps with the parallel bars and then with crutches. And then we'd try to do, you know, steps up, you know, and then it was how many flights you could do. And slowly but surely, I started to get more and more back. And I was quite fortunate that my injury turned out to be what they call an incomplete spinal cord injury. So I had this possibility of having some physical improvement over time, and the days turned into weeks and into months and into years, and slowly but surely I just got a little bit better and a little bit better, and managed to get a lot of it back. Still, you know, I still 20 years later deal with a lot of complications because of the spinal cord injury, but I, you know, people obviously won't be able to see on this, but I can now walk. I can do a lot of stuff that I never thought I'd have an opportunity to do again. You know, I can walk and things, but I can't run, I can't jump. But I can do a lot of things that I never thought I'd ever be able to do again. And it's been a long journey, but it's been a journey made up of like individual days, just like little bricks in a wall that have just been slowly stacked up. And you feel like you're not making any improvement when you go day to day, but you look back and you go like, yeah, we're getting there, you know. And over time, it's added up, and it's certainly been well worth it to stay in the game.
Okay, so you say you can walk, but you can't run. When did you decide then, oh, I think I'm going to try and ride a motorcycle again? And how was the reaction when you told your family that as well? Because you must have quite the special wife to then say, yes, try again.
so for me, you know, I'm like a goal-driven guy. And I think a lot of people are like that, you know, guys and girls and all sorts, where, you know, you have a goal, it gives you something to work towards. And that's what gives you motivation each day to keep going. You know, you got this thing that you're aiming towards. And so I had a goal to race the Dakar Rally on a motorcycle. And it was a goal that I had before I was, you know, I broke my back. It was a goal I'd had from my early 20s. And then breaking my back and being paralyzed and being in that hospital, I thought about my whole life and I thought about all these kind of things. And one of the things I did think about was that goal to race the Dakar Rally. And in that hospital, lying there paralyzed, I made the decision that that's what I'm going to do. I'm still going to race the Dakar. That's going to be a physical goal, and that's going to be the thing that's going to drive me physically to keep getting better. And so that was something that was there right from the beginning, in the hospital, that it was that decision. And it was 2.5 years later, was the first time that I ever rode a motorcycle again. And it was a little bit by chance. We were actually with my family and we were pulling up to have a picnic, and my buddy was in the felt across the road with a motorcycle, a mate of his, and we went over and we started chatting a bit, and he kind of did the whole thing of like, hey, you want to give it a go, you know? And and I was like, yeah, let's do it. And I rode this motorcycle for just, you know, about 200 meters in a big circle around a flat piece of felt. But being in a place where I couldn't run, I couldn't jump, I couldn't do a lot of the sports that I used to do, to be able to just sit on that bike and twist that throttle and just ride and move effortlessly was just incredible. And it was certainly a moment where I was like, yeah, this is amazing. And I was like, yeah, we're gonna definitely chase this goal hard. And I think, you know, you mentioned briefly now about my wife, Meredith, and obviously our marriage and things, and to have a spouse that has a big bike accident and then they want to go back and ride again. It's like, yeah, that's crazy, man. That just makes no sense. But I think all of us have different passions and all of us have different things that make us feel alive and that we enjoy life and that kind of stuff. And for me, that was a big part of my life. It's a big part of my life that brings me a lot of joy. It brings me a lot of adventure. It fulfills a lot of needs I have as the type of guy I have, or the type of guy I am. And so certainly to go back and to do the things that I love again was part of me healing, and it's part of who I am. And so for her, she was very accepting of me doing that. Obviously it's a worry, it is dangerous, you know, all these kind of things, but it's part of who I am, and it's part of what makes me who I am is that I am someone who loves these kind of things, and I need an element of risk and adventure and that kind of stuff in my life. And so she was incredibly supportive for me to ride again and things like that. And obviously I'm careful, and it's a lot more like, hey, all good, finish the ride, on our way home, you know, kind of stuff. But you know, we managed all those things, and it was amazing to be able to ride again and go in the mountains with my buddies and go to Lesotho and you know, sleep in the wild and, you know, just do the things that I used to love, you know. And I think when you have a close call with your life, you realize everything you have, and a life that's not lived and not doing what you want to do, you're just alive. You're not living. It's a waste. You got to do those things. And so that's kind of how we both saw it.
That's great. And I think she also knew that that is the man that she married. If you weren't like that, you would not be the man she fell in love with. And to accept your spouse and your partner for who they are. And so that's beautiful. On this podcast, I talk a lot about what we say in Afrikaans, die hart van 'n ma, the heart of a mom. So now I really want to speak about the heart of a dad. Something that me as a mother does not understand, but I have a wonderful husband, a loving father as well. So let's speak about how your fatherhood has played a role in all these decisions as well. How did you go about processing this? And when you actually went and you qualified and you did go to do the Dakar, you can tell us about that now. What role did your four, then a little bit older, but still young daughters play in that decision? And how did they support you? Tell us about the Dakar.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I'll start with the Dakar side. So It took me 10 years from being paralyzed to learn to walk again, learn to ride again. I had to start to race again. I had to qualify to race Dakar. So it was a lot of racing and a lot of like building up a CV and things like that to get accepted to race Dakar. And I had to go and race over in Morocco. We did a big 6-day race through the Sahara and things like that to eventually get everything I needed. And so it was a long, long, long 10-year journey. And I've often thought, you know, about these kind of things, because as a lot of us become parents, we want what's best for our children, and we want our children to do better than us and all that, all those kind of things. And I'm a huge believer in that, and we'll touch a bit more on that now. But part of being a good dad or a good mom is that you keep your cup full as well, because you can't fill an empty cup, you know. And I think sometimes people fall, and I think there's been times in my life as well, but sometimes you fall into the trap of living 100% for your children. And it sounds like really noble to say you do that, but you're not doing them any favors, because if they grow up and they live 100% for their children and put all their own personal goals and dreams on the back burner, then they don't live their lives fully, and then they do their children do the next for their children, and no one actually ever lives. And so you have to find this balance of chasing your own goals and dreams and fulfilling your needs as a person and as a couple outside of your children's lives as well. And so I worked very hard over those 10 years to balance that. And so I was really determined. I wasn't going to be one of these guys who blindly chases my own goals and dreams, and in the process, I lose my family. You know, I destroy my marriage, and I destroy this family unit. That would not be a win, you know, no matter what you do in a sporting world or any other hobby or anything like that. If you lose your family in the process because of that, that's a loss. No matter how you see it, you lost, man. And so I'm a big believer in balance. And there were times when over those 10 years where I wasn't riding enough, or I wasn't doing the things I wanted to do enough, and I was frustrated, and I was like, I feel like I'm not living my life. But you know, I'm spending tons of time with the kids, and we're doing lots of stuff together as a couple and those kind of things, but I'm feeling frustrated inside. And then there were other times where I'm racing way too much, and I'm doing way too much on that side. And then the family starts to suffer a bit. And so I see my life as like these three different things. And the one is me as an individual and my needs for adventure and to live my life and, you know, in that world. And then the second one is myself and Meredith, just us, not the children, just the two of us as a couple. And then the third one is us as a family. So now it's me, Meredith, and my girls. And so I find I have to keep all of these at a good level. And sometimes you do this and you go, whoops, bring this one. Oh, no, this one back up, kind of thing like that.
Like Tetris.
Yeah, exactly. But if we balance those three things, then for myself, for our marriage, for us as a family, it works great. And obviously, you know, my wife, Meredith, she's balancing her three as well, you know, and my daughters now, as they're getting older, they're balancing their three. And so it's like, if we got that right, and you never get it right, you always, you know, a bit skew here and there, but if you keep bringing, well, I can't say if you, I say for me, if I keep bringing it back to that point where I'm balancing these three areas, it works, and it works great, because then I'm a great dad, and I'm going to my kids' sport events, and I'm reading them stories at night, and I'm cleaning up vomit in the middle of the night from the carpet, and I'm doing all the things that dads are supposed to do, you know, and I'm doing school runs, and I'm you know helping in all those different areas, and I'm a dad that they can talk to, and we can help work through all the challenges of growing up and that kind of stuff together, But I'm also then making sure that, because as we're getting close to now, we're very close to the point where it's me and Meredith, and we've had two of our daughters, you know, move out. The other two are early 20s now, and the one's leaving in a couple of weeks. And then we've got one left at home, and, you know, she's now finishing her studies, and we're very like at this point where it's just the two of us. And so if we hadn't looked after all of that for all these years, you know, this can be a pretty crazy time. So, you know, trying to balance all these areas. And so over those years, that's what we always do, is you try to balance all the areas to look after all those things. And so that's kind of been that 10-year journey. And so being a dad is hugely important. And the effect that it's had on my daughters, when I look back now, and by me chasing, you know, my own goals and dreams at the same time as balancing it with the other responsibilities, is that it's allowed them to dream. It's allowed them to go like, yeah, I can do big things too, and I can overcome big challenges, and it's good to like throw yourself all in with passion and just go like go and try stuff and do things. So I think it certainly helped them to dream big as well, being part of a family where people dream big and we chase crazy goals and that kind of stuff. So it's definitely worked out that it's helped me, but it has helped them as well.
Just wondering, yeah, do any of them ride motorcycles?
Yeah, so two of them learned to ride. The two younger ones, they were like, they wanted to ride. And I was like, no, you enjoy your swimming and your gymnastics and dancing or whatever. You know, you don't kind of risk in your life. I don't want to be, you know, as a dad, it's very different riding yourself or having little girls that ride, you know what I mean? But along with how I believe you should live your life, it's like, yeah, that's what they want to do, then absolutely. And so I actually got them full sets of kits with little helmets and I got them, intercoms on their helmets. So with little, what do you call them? Earphones inside and a microphone and stuff. And I kitted their helmets with that and got these little motorbikes and I'd go down to a soccer field and we'd put out cones and I'd have my headset on so I could speak to them while they're riding. I'm like, hey, slow down, you know, through the cone. Put out, do this, you know, kind of thing. And so I was like this probably crazy strict helicopter dad when it came to riding after even all I've done. And so, yeah, two of them learned to ride and we got to do a lot of rides together. We did some rides in the felt together and all sorts of stuff. And obviously to be a dad out in the bush felt with your daughters riding motorcycles is pretty cool. And one of them went on and got her bike license and all that sort of stuff. But where they are now, neither of them are riding at the moment. They've kind of moved on with other hobbies and interests and things like that. But I think they may come back to it. But two of them know how to ride, and we've had some good daddy daughter times together.
Yeah, and I think it gives a great spirit of adventure. But Joey, I want to know, I think a lot of the viewers and listeners, maybe though, some might know of the Dakar and they're now wondering, but did you finish? Maybe a few have no idea. Well, they'll have heard of it, but just maybe a sentence or two just to tell those who know nothing about it. What is it? And how did it go when you, as someone who was formerly basically paralyzed and then 10 years later, you went to do the Dakar? How did it go when you were there? This was now also 10 years ago, if my calculations are correct.
Yeah. 2017 was the year I went and raced the Dakar, and I was fortunate enough to get the entry, but I had no money to go to Dakar, and it cost like well over R1 million to go and race Dakar. And so we had to raise that money, and as a family, we did all sorts of fundraisers and things like that. And so my daughters and my wife Meredith were a huge part of that, and we did all sorts of things to raise money, and we raised over R1 million. And you know, we got to go to Dakar, and then it's a 2-week race. So it's 13 days of racing and it's 9,000 kilometers. So to give you an idea, that's further than from Cape Town to Cairo in those 13 days. And we raced through Argentina, Paraguay and Bolivia, through the Andes Mountains, the Atacama Desert. It was incredible. And my Dakar turned out to be one of the craziest things that it happened to a biker at Dakar. And so I'll obviously keep it short. We don't have a lot of time, on this one, but the short version is I finished every day right near the back, you know, sometimes stone last. And so it was hard. It was way harder than I thought. And at the end of day three, I was so destroyed. I thought I need to just go home. You know, I'm not physically capable of doing this. I have a lot of physical challenges, as I mentioned, that I still deal with and things, and I was out of my league. But I just kind of broke it down to one day at a time, and I broke those days down to 10 meters at a time, and I just hacked my way through until the second last day on day 12, where a car came up behind me and trying to get out of the way, stuck in a rut and everything. I went down and the car missed me at speed just by a few centimeters, but he crashed into my bike and rode over my bike and completely destroyed my bike on the second last day. And it was this 10-year dream and all this money and all this sacrifice. And it was over on the second last day in some semi-arid desert in South America. And it was really difficult that moment. But when I was there, I decided that I wouldn't quit the race, that I would stay in the race until I was time barred. And the way you get time barred is you miss your start time the next day at the next point. And I was 660 kilometers away from that point. And my start time was 4 a.m. the next day. And it was 10 a.m. more or less when I was hit by the car. And I'm stone lost. And so I said, I'm staying in till 4 a.m. the next morning, no matter what, you know, and then I'll be out then. But I'm not going to press the button on my bike and quit this race. And so I stripped that bike and I had to strip the whole exhaust off because it was flattened. I had no foot peg. I had a damaged radiator and the whole frame's bent and everything's destroyed. But I managed to get it limping along, stone last. There was no ways I was going to get that distance. I was running out of fuel because I'd lost all my fuel with all the petrol tanks being damaged. And I, with a bike in such bad condition, it was just limping along. And so even though I got this bike working, I'm out the race. But I just did 10 meters, 10 meters, 10 meters. And then a couple hours later, after limping along, being out of this race and hours behind the guy who was second last, I found a bike in the desert from a guy who'd crashed his bike and he'd been medevaced out in the helicopter. And this bike was just standing there, the same bike as mine in the middle of the desert. And I stripped that bike and I used parts from that bike to fix mine because I'm not allowed to ride that bike. You know, it's the other competitor's bike. Even though he's been medevaced out, I can't ride his bike, but I can strip it. And so I stripped all these parts off the bike and I put them onto mine and it took me a long time. And then I rode alone for hours and hours and hours the rest of that day. Now with a bike that was like reasonably repaired, it wasn't right. And I rode right into the night and I rode past midnight and it was about 2:15 in the morning where I got to the second last bivouac and I had 1 hour of sleep and I made my start time at 4 a.m. And then I rode the final day to finish the Dakar Rally in 2017.
That was amazing. And I remember because I worked as a journalist at that time. My husband as well was a photographer. I'll put the picture up here when we speak. He was a field newspaper photographer and you received quite the Euro's welcome at the airport. It must have been great to see your family in that moment because everyone then learned of your story of this guy. And Joey wrote a book as well. Everyone who's listening, I'll put the cover on here as well so you can go read the full story from Para to Dakar. And what was it like walking out there to the airport and seeing your family and knowing that you made it?
It was honestly incredible. And it's one of those days, you know, you have those days in your life where you're like, you know, it just gets like burnt into your memory. And sometimes these days are like burnt into your memory for good reasons and sometimes for bad reasons. And obviously I had a couple of bad ones along the way, but that was definitely a good one that was there forever. And, you know, Meredith was there and my daughters were there. And then it was like just tons of people, you know, and it was Carte Blanche and Super Sport and all those kind of bike magazines and all sorts of stuff. It was certainly a day that I'll remember forever. It was incredible. And just to kind of like give you a little bit of a wrap up on this whole thing is that, you know, by me chasing that goal, it changed my life forever. And in turn, it changed my family's lives because you mentioned now, you know, I wrote a book about the whole thing, you know, from Paris to Dakar. And after that, I got asked to share my story and to share my journey with different, you know, bike shops and things like that. And then the guys, they were like, hey, come tell the story of that company and things. And so then I started, like, you could say a whole new career, speaking at corporate events. And over the last, you know, like eight years or so now, I've been fortunate enough to speak in just over 50 countries, you know, all over the world. And it's been amazing. And it's certainly changed my life. It's changed the places I've been. It's changed my income, you know, what I can do and those kind of things. And in turn with that, to give you an idea, I never got to study after school, you know. It was something that just wasn't not a possibility really for me and the way I grew up and those kind of things. And my wife, Meredith, she never got to go to university either or anything like that. And we were determined that we wanted our daughters to be able to do those things or have the opportunity to chase their own goals and dreams. And by me racing Dakar, it was able to change how we were financially and things like that. One of the things that probably makes me proudest as a dad is that, and for us as a couple, is that we've been able to pay for all of our daughters to study further. And, you know, now we're in a place where we've got four daughters that have all got tertiary education in the careers of their dreams, exactly what they wanted to do. And now they go on to go into the world and to chase their own goals and dreams. And so I think that, as a dad or as a parent, it's super important that you chase your own goals and dreams while still being, a great dad or a great mom. But you do have to chase those dreams at the same time.
That's actually just what I wanted to ask, because looking back now, 20 years ago, you know, now your kids are grown. But maybe, do you have any other final words for specifically the dad who, where you were 20 years ago, who's in the thick of things? The kids are small, like you say, it's the middle of the night, someone's vomiting. You just feel like it's everywhere. You don't have enough time for each other as a couple, or you're working hard, and there's some really big challenge in your life. Maybe for them, it's not a motorcycle challenge, but maybe you lose your job. Just something that feels so big that you feel you cannot handle this, that it is just too much for that person, or specifically a dad. We're speaking about the heart of a dad who feels like this mountain in front of him is just too big to climb. Any words of wisdom for that person listening today?
You know, I'm not a guy that's like, I've studied all psychology and all sorts of stuff, and I've got like these great words of wisdom, you know, but I can tell you what's helped me. And I think, you know, by me sharing the things that helped me can maybe help some other guys out there. The first thing that I would say is that it's when you hit those dark, dark times where it's really tough, and guys go through that, like you were saying now, losing jobs and all those kind of things. It's hard, man. Like it's really, really tough. And there's a lot of things that I've experienced that have been tough, but there's other things that are, like, in my opinion, way tougher than things that I've been through that can happen to guys and to families and things like that. And the first thing I'd say is, when you're in those really, really tough times, don't think about the whole setup and how it all plays out and all of these massive, you know, challenges and stuff. The strategy that I used was, I would say, okay, just today. And I'd get up that morning and I'd be like, right, what can I do today? And I'd just focus on that day. And then you just tick off that day and you go to bed and you just get through that night, because sometimes those are harder than the days. And then I'd go like, right, just today. And you go another day. And eventually you get through those dark nights and you get through those dark days and it does get better, because each day that you try just that day, it's that little brick in the wall that slowly is just getting placed there, and it just starts adding up. And so that would be the first thing I'd say. And then, you know, I'm a girl dad, you know, I got four daughters. So when it comes to girls, the advice that I would give is that often as dads, we want to protect them against everything. We want to protect them their whole lives, man. We want to be that dude who's in the background, who's ripped and carrying a gun and is going to freaking, you know, don't you mess with my girl, you know, kind of thing, you know, and that's like a guy thing. You know, we want to be that guy, but you don't do your daughter any favors by being that guy. The way that you help your daughters, is you teach them to be, strong, badass woman. That's what you need to do. And so when you're raising, you know, my advice would be, when you're raising girls is allow them to live, allow them to be strong, you know, empower them, because you won't be able to protect them forever. And so the way you protect them is by helping them to be strong. Yeah, you know, they need to, you know, you need to guide them and help them and those kind of things, but you need to allow them to sometimes make mistakes, and you need to allow them to experience life and not to be overprotective, because you're not helping them when you do that.
Thanks so much. I also have two daughters, so definitely taking that to heart. Thank you so much, Joe. I appreciate it. I have a final question that I always ask to my guests, so I would like you to share as well. Tell me about your parents and what did you learn from them?
Okay, cool. So, yeah, I grew up you know, in Kempton, you know, my whole life and things. Sadly, my mom passed away in COVID. She actually passed away from a heart attack, and it was a sudden thing. She was super healthy. She was like, I think she was 72, 71, 72 at the time, but she could still do like cartwheels and go running and stuff, you know. And it was just one day she passed, which was really tough, and it was really sad. My dad now lives in the UK, but growing up, yeah, there was a few things. If I say from my dad, one of the things that I learned was to, I think to be kind and to serve others. So my dad was, or is, you know, very, very selfless. And he was the kind of guy that would be driving on the road. And if you saw in the distance, there's a car on the side of the road that's broken down. Oh, you know, dad's stopping, because he would always do that, you know. So he was that guy. And so he was certainly, you know, he would always be like looking out for other people. That was something that I definitely learned from him. In terms of my mom, I would say there was like two big things that kind of stand out for me as a son. And I was one of six children, so it was a big family, you know. For my mom, she was, I remember she said to me once, she was petrified of dogs, like petrified. She was super scared of dogs, but she would never show she was scared of dogs in front of us, because she was very much determined not to pass her fears on to her children. That was a big thing for her. And so, you know, so I think that, like, how could I say, like, be tough when you need to be tough kind of thing would be the one thing that I'd remember from that. And she would always say something to me. She'd always say, Joey, you're a survivor. You're a survivor. And this is a horrible, horrible one you're asking me.
It's okay, because you know, every single episode where I ask this, everyone gets emotional when they speak about their mom.
Oh, that's why you
and
do
I
it.
Think it's okay.
That's how you do it. But okay, so it's working. Well done. Yeah, she'd always say that. And I think, I guess as a boy growing up, when you're told something again and again and again, you believe it. And I think as most children, that's an important thing, you know, that you have this positive reinforcement that's kind of built into you, and it gets built into your personality. And so I think for me, that's, man, you're mean. It's one of those things that's like certainly helped me many, many times in my life. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks so much. And I want to thank you for sharing your story. I heard you as a speaker at an event a couple of weeks ago, and I was so touched, and I just knew I wanted to interview you. And thank you for sharing your story now with a wider audience. I really know this is going to make a difference in so many people's lives, and there's always someone out there that needs to hear these words that you said. So thank you. Especially on Father's Day, sharing a positive message about masculinity, about being a dad, and celebrating being a girl dad as well. Thank you so much, Joey. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And thank you for giving me those difficult questions that push me to the emotional limit. And I just want to let everyone out there know that I'm still a really tough biker guy. Don't you read too much into this.